Blog Talk Radio.
Bones sinking like stones, all that we fall for. Homes, places we've grown, all of us have done.
Greetings, everybody. Thank you guys for joining me for another episode of Haru Presents. I am your host, Haru. And guys, I hope you like the broadcast of Haru Presents. I am stalling because I am not ready, actually. I do these pop-up shows. You know, I want these shows to be authentic as possible. You know what I mean? And normally I'm ready, I'm on it, I'm prepared, everything, boom, boom, you know what I mean? But to kind of be not prepared, you know, in its rawness, you know what I mean? I think that that's good for people to see, too. So I am just going to get right into it. How about that? Let's just dive right in, all right? So on today on Haru Presents, guys, this is a broadcast of White Woman Tells the Truth About White Supremacy. Now, we do know that when it comes to race, you know, race, slavery, all these programs in which they were used, you know, to keep us separated, to keep us fighting, to keep us enslaved, you know, they are all, even black, you know what I mean? They are fucking programs, y'all, and we're going to have to elevate from all of this shit, like all of it, you know. Mind control is their name of the game. And as long as they can, you know, control you in any way, and then, oh, God, what is the biggest world deception, you know? And I ask that, and a lot of people say God. I'm one of them. I say God. But to hear from some of my people, you know, there were some great answers, you know what I mean? But just think about it. What has been the world's biggest deception? You know, a lot of us know about religion. A lot of us know about slavery. Now we're learning about the okay, it's in my other phone, but
Enhance your mind. Recharge your spirit. Awaken your soul. Enhancing Awareness Radio. Enhancing awareness with clarity.
All right, all right, all right. Some last minute trip ups there. I do apologize about that. Well, no, I don't apologize because I'm not sorry. I do not apologize, right? Fuck etiquette. I'm not sorry. Shit happens. We back. All right, how about that? All right, y'all. So on today's broadcast, Hulu presents White Woman Speaks the Truth About White Supremacy. Now, herself, I really didn't know who she was, but let me, the lawnmower, you know, got all kind of distractions today in this moment. Isn't that lovely? Isn't it lovely? All right, so not sure who she is, but it'll tell you on the clip or whatever, but not sure who she is. Oh, Tim Wise, right? Tim Wise is another one. He's another good one who breaks down when it comes to white supremacy. So go on YouTube and look for Tim Wise, all right? He's really, really great. They have scrubbed and removed a lot of his shit, but dude was letting you know. I think early on, that's kind of what sparked my awakening and research, him. So to dig deeper on a lot of stuff. So anyway, guys, here is coming from the horse's mouth, okay? White Woman Tells the Truth About White Supremacy. It's about a 47-minute clip. I hope you guys enjoy it. I may not be back on, but what I'm doing is, guys, I'm pulling the research and the stuff that helped me get more into that, like the good, like my favorites, right? Haru's favorites. Be sure to check out our website, www.enhancingawarenessradio.net. Go to the section that says Haru's favorites. A lot of my favorite shows. I'm going to be adding my favorite books. The site is still under construction. But Haru's favorite, it's going to be a compiled list of all my life's journey. You know, favorite clips, books, articles, all of that, guys. It's going to be under the Haru favorite section on our website. All right? So thank you, thank you, thank you. Gratitude to the energy for all of it. Gratitude to the 360 for the totality of every facet of a being. Thank you to the ancestors who protect the ear platform, the energy who protects the ear platform, the 444,000 energy that covers ear. You know what I mean? I see you. I see how you route things. I just see how it all, you know, folds. You know, this is bigger than Haru, New York. And we do understand that at ear. So gratitude to be in sync, right, to bring this forth. So Haru presents White Woman Tells the Truth About White Supremacy. Go ahead and enjoy, guys. Please be sure to check us out on every weekend, Motivational Class on Saturday, Spiritual Soul Sunday on Sunday, and both are at 11 a.m. Eastern, 10 Central. All right, guys. Thank you.
name is Sabrina Johnson, and I'm here at the Race Relations Institute at Fisk University here in Nashville, Tennessee. Today is Friday, July 14th, the year 2000. I'm classified as a non-white person, and I'm here at the Race Relations Institute because I'm interested in understanding about the system of racism, white supremacy, with the intent, ultimately, of ending the system of racism, white supremacy. If you would please state your name and tell us why you're here.
My name's Farrell Winfrey. I live in Roane County in East Tennessee. I'm here because I recognize the white supremacy system of racism. I recognize that, and with the acknowledgement that it exists, then there falls on me a responsibility to try to do something to stop that, to cause that discrepancy in privilege and in justice, and when it becomes your responsibility, then you have to try to do something. And I'm here to learn. I came because of the names of the people that I saw that were going to be here, and I knew I could learn from them. I'm white. Now, when I say that, my people a long time ago came up with these little check marks that we have to check, which we are white. And in reality, it's white or non-white. You know, they break that down into a lot of we break that down into a lot of different groups. But the fact that I do not know in my ancestry of any one being in my ancestry, the line, I don't know of anyone being there that was non-white. So I put that little check mark where white is. And then that makes me the problem. So I'm here to try to learn how I can try to solve that problem.
Okay. Yes, over the last couple of days, I've had the opportunity to participate in formal group discussion with you, with other white people and other non-white people. And I must say that in my experience in dialoguing about racism with white people and non-white people, I have never experienced a person who classifies themselves as white being so honest and forthright and providing helpful insight about racism to non-white people. So I want to say we appreciate your participation and your disclosures to us towards the objective of solving the problem, ending racism.
That adage of the most I can do is the least I can do.
Mm-hmm.
See, that's a reality. What we have done for hundreds of years, it can never be undone with words, but words can bring an understanding, and until that understanding comes that brings an awareness to my people of what they have and are doing, things are not ever going to change. The changes have to come from action, but the actions have to be brought about by words. So I praise God if that has happened, and if I've been able to be a part of that, then I praise Him for it, and I thank you for saying it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's been my experience that when people who are classified as non-white dialogue with people who classify themselves as white about racism, emotions tends to really run high. And so I really appreciate that you believe, as we believe, as you stated, that truth is more important than comfort, because oftentimes non-white people feel embarrassed and white people feel offended when a discussion about racism occurs. So we look forward to doing what I believe is the Creator's will, and that is for us to live in truth, not in denial and deceit.
Yes.
And I recognize that that is necessary in order to end racism. Could you begin by stating what your perspective is about the existence of racism? Just talk about what it is.
I agree with the principle, the theory, the principle, that racism is prejudice plus power. I had a conversation yesterday with a black man, and he said that he knew some of his people who were racist. And I talked with him about that, because without the power to take that prejudice and actively place it into position to cause people to do or not do, then it is simply just prejudice. And I believe that, so that's the premise from which I come. That racism, you have to have that power in order for there to be racism. And most white people would look at me and say, I don't have any power. But we do have power. We have power just getting up in the morning and looking in the mirror and not having to think about race. That places us into a position to where our minds are clear, and that it's a problem that we don't have to deal with. We don't think about it because we don't have to think about it. It's not something that completely controls our lives. So there, from the very beginning, when we wake up of the morning, then we have an advantage, and that advantage comes from the color of the skin. When we go into a store and we're not assumed that we're going to be a shoplifter simply because of the color of our skin, that is an advantage. When I walk down the street and I'm more safe, now that's not saying nothing would happen ever to me, but I would be more safe walking down the street alone than you would be. That is racism, because of that unequal playing field that's there, that gives me advantage simply because of the color of my skin, then that's what's wrong. See, the fact that there's anything out there. I told, I've been accused of betraying my people, my race, my faith, my gender, you know, everything, because of the beliefs that I have, that when we take advantage of those things, then we are being white supremacists. Because most people, when they think about someone that's white supremacist, they're thinking about the guy in the fatigues, and he's in the woods and he's shooting and, you know, target. But I am being white supremacist when I accept an establishment that gives me more than it gives you. If I know that, if this is something that I'm aware of, and I take advantage of that, then that makes me, I believe, that puts me in the category of being a white supremacist. Now, how do I not take advantage of it? What, you know, because I've had white people ask me this, how do I not take advantage of it? Do I not take a job that I know is given to me because I'm white, and if I had been black, I wouldn't have gotten that job? Do I not take that job? I have to eat. My children have to eat. So we get into reality, and there are things that we cannot not do. So we are white supremacists because we are taking advantage of a system. But what we have to do, what we must do, is to try to stop that system from being as it is. Try to undermine that system in any way that is legal and not going to land you in jail, hopefully, rightfully land you in jail. You have to fight it. You have to try to stop it. But that still doesn't stop you from taking advantage, because every day of your life as a white person, all day, every day, everything that you do, everywhere you go, you are taking advantage of being white. Most of my people, they don't think about that. They've never had to think about that, which is the greatest advantage of being white. They don't have to think about it. It's not a determining factor in their life. That is a conscious factor. And I'm talking too much.
No, you're not talking too much. As a person who classifies themselves as white, and even as white supremacist, as you have just stated, what specifically do you view your role to be as you interact with other people who classify themselves as white?
I've said for a long time that God's placed me on a path that there's not many other footprints on that path. There are some. Thaddeus Stevens is one. He's one of my heroes. Most white people wouldn't have any idea who he is. I have the responsibility to try to change it. I don't actively celebrate the 4th of July because you don't have freedom. You're not free. You have oppression every day of your life. If you have children, when those children are born, you have to immediately begin to teach them what they cannot do in order to survive. And I love the Lord. Everything that I do is because I read the scripture and I see direction that's given to me that I don't hear white preachers preaching. See, I don't hear it in the pulpit. And I don't understand why I don't hear it in the pulpit. So my response, I'm the one that causes it. It's not, I don't understand white people that talk and in their words the blame is placed on the recipient of the oppression. You know, like, okay, the oppression is here, so get out of the way and then you're not going to be oppressed anymore. That's not how it works. I am the oppressor, so the responsibility is mine to stop that. Now, stopping it, that's different. It's hard because I don't have any power other than the power of being white and taking advantage of I don't have money. I don't have influence. So how I stop it, I don't really have anything except a big mouth and words that I know are wrong when I see a wrong. And if something's wrong, God says it's your responsibility to change it. And I know we don't want a sermon here, but I believe he's going to hold us accountable for the things that we've done and are doing, and do not try to make a difference to change. And when I stand in front of him, I want to have some of those things where he's going to say, I know you worked at this. Everybody always wants to know what's your angle, especially non-white people. What is it? You know, why are you doing this? And of course that comes from 500 years of white people not doing anything good, unless there's something in it for them. And I understand that. And in a way, I'm in that same category there. I have children. I have grandchildren, more grandchildren on the way. I don't want those children growing up having to dodge bullets. And the young black man is, he's a much different product of our oppression than what the young black man was 100 years ago. I don't want my children in a civil war in this country between black and white. So in that way I'm selfish, see. And the fact that I want God to smile on me and say, I've seen you do, that in itself is selfish. But he's also given me a burden. And there's not any way that I can ever say to you that I know what you go through. See, there's no way that I can do that. And he gives me understanding that I can't do that. I can't know what your life is because of the color of your skin, because of the amount of melanin that God placed in your skin. I can't know that, but he has given me a heart to hear the pain when your child is mistreated because of the color of that child's skin, that beautiful child. He's given me the ability to have a small degree of understanding about that, and for me not to act on it would be unforgivable in his sight.
How did you come to this level of understanding and the decision to speak the way you speak and do what you do? Because as you said, for instance, you don't hear from the pulpit from white preachers who read the scripture and promote and encourage Christian living, for instance. But yet, your faith path seems to be the same, yet you have a different perspective. What influencing factors caused you to be where you are?
I don't want it to sound trite when I say that God reached down and touched me at an early age. I had, excuse me, if any of my kinfolk ever see this, then I'll lose more than what I've lost already. I was born into a family where my father was an overt racist, my mother was a covert racist. But both of them had very strong, I always felt like my mother was more dangerous in that respect. But so it was not something that came to me from training as childhood. But I was also born with cardiac lesion. And through that, I was different from other children because I was so ill at a certain period of time when other children were out running and playing. So I was different, which gave me an understanding of what it was like, how people felt to be different. And then as I got older, this knowledge that these things were wrong, as I acted on those things, things happened to me, adverse things. I belonged to a Southern Baptist church. I was saved in that church. And I was thrown out of that church in my early 20s, which was back in the 60s, because I taught that racism was wrong in a Sunday school class. I was asked to leave that church. And the elder of the church, the deacon of the church that came to me and talked to me about it the first time was my grandfather. And he said, you can't say these things. And I said, I can't not say these things. And so he came back with other deacons and they asked me. So it's been a process. But then when my youngest son was in the seventh grade, he brought home with him a young black male child that was in his class. And he came in, and my children have always believed that with my mouth I could make anything right, you know, I could speak. And he came in, and John, the African-American child's name, he stayed outside, and Mark came in, and Mark said to me, Mama, I've got a friend, and you've got to help him. And when we talked, John was a big, strong, athletic child, and if someone called him a word, if they called him nigger, if they said something, then he just got mad, fought. And Mark said, he's going to kill somebody and end up in jail. You got to talk to him. You got to help him. And because of the circumstances, he was the child of a single mother, and her job was second shift. It evolved in that he stayed with us from Sunday night when his mother went to work until Friday afternoon when he would go home and then be with his mother and his sisters in the afternoons and the weekend, and she would bring him back. So he lived with us, and we would get threats because we lived in a white neighborhood and John was living with us. Mark, it reached a point where Mark would be more angry than John would at the things that would happen at school because they loved each other. They cared about each other. We had one bed in their bedroom, so they traded out. One slept on the floor, and the other one had the bed, and the next night it reversed, you know. But through him, because he constantly had to fight, he wouldn't do anything, but he had to fight. And through this, I really got a taste of what your people go through. I didn't understand how he felt, but I got a taste of it. And the lesson that I was trying to give him, that Mark kept saying, Mama, talk to him, you got to, you know, was, John, if they say something to you and it causes a reaction in you, that even if you whip them, they've still controlled what you've done. They've still been the one that caused the reaction or the reaction in you. And through this, but, you know, so many stories of injustice for him and the things that we went through as a family because of our association, just simply because we loved him. All of these things. See, God doesn't set you on a path and not prepare you for that path. So all of these things, being different myself, being struck down by my own people because of what I believe, and then loving someone. I'm not sure any white person could ever enter into this battle and be on this side of the firing line unless they love someone of color, because most of us isolate ourselves. We can get up in the morning, go to work, go shopping, go do everything in our life that has to be done without coming in contact with you. So unless we love someone, we don't know what you think, what you feel. And don't tell me my best friend is, you know, because I hear that all the time. I've got a, my best friend is black. You know, I don't want to hear that.
I hear that a lot too.
Mm-hmm.
If you've stated that you're interested in solving this problem and ending racism, in your view, if the system of racism, white supremacy, is ended, what benefits will white people experience?
The guilt would go away, for one thing. Well, the present day guilt, because we can't ever undo what we've done. So, but that's difficult. What would we gain? Because most people ask me, what would we lose? That's a difficult question. Peace. Because racism is the cause of the problems that we have in this country. It's the cause of the crime. It's, you know, racism is, I feel like, the backbone of all ills that this country has. So we'd gain peace. We would also gain knowing you, and knowing about your culture, what you still know of it, because we've robbed you of most of it. We would gain that if the day ever came when I could walk into a place of work and you could be there wearing whatever clothing you wanted to wear, whether it was clothing that depicted your African descent, or wearing your hair. White people tend to say, well, that's another question, I guess. We would gain knowing you, see, because we don't know you. And that it, that robs us of a great blessing. We think we are entire and complete, and that we don't need to know you or anyone of color that is of a different belief. We close ourselves off and think that we're contaminated if we talk with someone of, and I'm talking about Christians, you know, I know more about Christians than I do any other faith, because that's me. But most Christians feel like they're contaminated if they talk to anyone that's of a different faith. So we rob ourselves of that. So if racism ended, we would have that. I can't say it better than knowing you.
Mm-hmm. Some would probably argue, some non-white people in particular would probably argue that indeed, we think white people know non-white people, and by that knowing, are more able to control and dominate and keep the power dynamic as it is. How would you respond to that?
We know what we've done to you. And we know what over 500 years we've put in your heads. And we know how to utilize that. And we know how to take advantage of that. And we even know how to have a black friend. We know the dynamics of who is in control. And I don't care how much the system has changed to the point to where what is politically correct at this point might be different from what was politically correct in the 50s. We still know where your place is. We know where our place is. And to me, the greatest deception that we've caused is that your people believe us when we say, this is my place and that is your place. Because I see evidence, and especially in seminars like this, because I will hear non-whites speak, and I hear them speak when they don't even know that they're speaking from a position that I have told them is the only way they're going to be allowed to succeed to that degree that I'm going to let them come up that ladder. Of course, I'm just going to let them come up so far. But the greatest sadness for me is that they don't even know. See, I have done such a good job that they don't even know that I've done this to them. A strong black man one time said to me, one of the greatest things you can do for my people is to stop shedding any tears. Because I'm very emotional. I get very emotional because this is my heart. And it's what I will probably die doing. I have no illusions about what my people think about the work that I do. And I realize that. But when I talk with someone, it would be very easy for me to begin to weep at what we do and what we have done. And he said to me, you must stop the tears because my people are so conditioned to putting their arms around you and comforting you when you weep. Then they are no longer strong. Their strength that is coming from standing up and saying, no, you're not going to treat me like that. That strength is gone because they've got their arms around you, comforting you. And I have tried to listen to the wisdom of that very, very wise man. I can't always, you know. When I sat in that room the other night, that when the author of Without Sanctuary, when he was speaking and those pictures were there of the lynching, the methods that we have used to keep control, I wept, you know, that I can. But when I wept, his words came back to me because all around me, the non-white people would reach out and comfort me. My God, there in front of, I don't understand it. See, I don't understand the closeness that your people have with the Mother Earth, with the concept of beginnings, God Himself. There is so much of that in you that you can forgive me and comfort me when I'm weeping at what I've done to you. See, that's beyond my it's beyond my understanding. I don't understand the kindness, the and I say the word forgiveness, and God forgive me for saying the word forgiveness, because another very wise black man said to me, don't ever ask my people for forgiveness, because the word forgiveness means the eradication of a debt. If someone owes you money and you forgive that debt, then they don't owe you anymore. And I don't want to ever be a part of, for even a moment between just the two of us, eradicating any part of the debt that I owe you, because it's a just debt. And it's a debt that needs to be repaid to the fullness of my ability to repay. So what I say to you is, I apologize for what my people, for what I've done to you, to your ancestors, to your children, and unless we're successful here, to your grandchildren. I apologize. And I mean that. See? And to any non-white that hears me. But I don't ask your forgiveness. Did I go off?
No, all of this is relevant and helpful. Speak as you will. You mentioned that white people who classify themselves as white, are aware, they know what has been done, what they have done over the years to non-white people. And there are two particular areas of activity that appear to be critical to maintaining the system of racism and white supremacy. These are activities that people all over the planet engage in. And the first one is religion. So can you talk specifically about what white persons have done to or taught non-white people in the area of religion in the context of racism?
You're wanting it to be where I can't ever go home, don't you? Christianity has been misused for hundreds of years to keep your people in subjugation. And I'm speaking now a reality that the history books do not record, but history does. Christianity was used because if I said, okay, you don't believe the way I believe, and Christianity is the best way to believe, so I'm going to take you, and it's going to be for your own good, honey. It's going to be for your own good. I'm going to take you, and I'm going to tear away everything about you and just keep your hands and your feet, because they can help me. I'm getting off. But I'm going to do this for your own good, because I'm going to give you a God. Now, what does that God look like? The reality of it is, when he came here, he didn't look like me. So what am I going to do about that? I'm going to make him look like me. So for hundreds of years, we've been telling you, and now you have to keep in mind that we took away any other God that you might have through force, through fear, through pain, through any means necessary. So now I'm going to give you a God, but I'm going to do that in a way that is going to further me. So I'm going to give you a God that looks like me, so that when you bow down to that God, you're bowing down to me. Because the reality is, and see, this is something that that bothered me when I left the church out of frustration, because I wasn't hearing these things. Because the Bible tells us what Jesus looked like when he walked here. The Bible tells us what he's going to look like when he comes back. We have taken that and changed it. One of my grandchildren, when he was about 8 years old, I have a black nativity in my home that I put out at Christmas. And he had been there several times, and all of a sudden one day he brings me the baby Jesus. And he says, "Mama, this is not right." And I said, "What's not right?" He said, "This is not right, Mama." Now, this is a child that every time he's with me, he gets lessons in this. My son says, to the point to where he has to deprogram them when he gets them back home. This child knows where my heart is. This child, but he's, "This is not right, Mama. What's wrong? Tell me. Jesus wasn't black. Jesus was white. Who told you that?" And then we have this great conversation. I tell them, it's not something you have to go back and fight. You don't have to go, because I don't want them beaten down until they're strong enough to know for what they believe, you know. But I want him to know the truth. I said, "In your mind, in your heart, know. Do you remember when Jesus went to Egypt? He hid in Egypt. The people in Egypt, honey, they're not white people. How could he hide that?" See, so that we've done that. We've given your people a God that looks like me so that you don't have any qualm about bowing down to me. See, because this is the image of God. I don't know of any sin that we've committed that's greater than that one. And we did it with the Bible in our hands when we were beating your ancestors for looking at us eye to eye, and we're quoting to them from this scripture. Even if we allowed them to have their own ministers, which there wasn't many of because we didn't allow them to read, but if we said, "Okay, you can have your church. This is my plantation. I'm going to do what I want with it. You can have your church." But then spies were sent. And those spies would stand outside the church, and that man would be beaten, perhaps killed, if he preached anything other than three sermons. And those three sermons were, "Turn the other cheek, obey your master, and it's going to get better one of these days. God's going to take care of all of it. You're going to be in a happy, happy land. So put up with what you're putting up with now." And we made your people preach that to your people. And it's still being done. It's still being done. Those are the sermons that your people hear. Those sermons are what causes your people to comfort me when I do something that's wrong. We've taken Christianity in the same way the Klan has taken.
Ooh. friendly announcer. I have serious news to pass on to everybody. What I'm about to say could mean the world's disaster, could change your joy and laughter to tears and pain. Is that love in need of love today? Don't delay, send your then right away. Hey, born round,
All right, y'all. All right. Peace. I wanted to come back on and end this particular broadcast, you guys, with saying that, you know, to anyone's listening, you know, when we think of white supremacy, we sometimes think, you know, these white people and what they did to us, you know, we get anger, we get rage, we get fear, you know, we get this thing. Everything that was stated in that particular clip was true, guys. Although it was true, it came from a place of kind of like a cry out, you know, for help, you know, as far as like, you know, we know that the secrets cannot be undone, and we know that, but how do we begin to balance this? You know what I mean? How do we begin to balance this, y'all? And I promise you, Mother Earth, you know, we can't trump nature, you guys. You know, I don't care how many people we kill. I don't care how many civil wars are fought. I don't care any of that, any of all of that, you guys. We cannot trump nature. So at the end of the day, guys, we have to be very wise and think, okay, what can we do really, you know, to redeem ourselves? You know what I'm saying? What can we do now? You know, and they are doing things, you know, for the people, which is great. You know, it's not about, you know, what has been done. It's really not about that. It's about what can we do now to make it better. So I want to leave with anyone that is listening to this, who opposition side, you know, and to everyone, let me say this, to everyone, what can we do in our now to make life better, not only for you and yours and your race and your, not only for you and yours, but what can we do collectively in compassion to make this life better for all of us? And on that note, I sign off.